Good morning. Welcome back to Save Your Breast. I am your host, Casey Polanco. Alongside, as always, is Dr. Nirav Savalia. Today, we are going to dive into a topic that has been brought up in some comments of our previous posts. Basically, our viewers are wondering, if a mastectomy doesn't guarantee that cancer won't return, then why is it even recommended in the first place? And to help us unpack on that convoluted topic, we are thrilled to be joined by Dr. Heather McDonald. Dr. McDonald is an OBGYN and a breast surgeon who is hand-selected and trained by Dr. Melvin Silverstein. She worked with Dr. Savalia for 15 years as faculty for the Keck School of Medicine, and she is also a certified menopause practitioner for the Menopause Society. She is somebody who has a deep expertise in both women's health and breast cancer risk. We're thrilled to have her here today to help us bring clarity to this topic and these nuanced decisions. So, Dr. McDonald, welcome to our office.
Thank you, Casey. Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Savalia. Very flattered to get the invitation.
Good. I know I see your patients all the time, and I talk to your staff all the time, but I never actually get to see you, whereas Dr. Savalia and you get to see each other all the time. That's quite the opposite. So first 15 years with Keck together and working with Dr. Silverstein, how long have you two known each other?
I'm sure I met you before I moved down here and joined Hoag.
You did.
But we really got to know each other when I joined Hoag, and we started sharing patients and operating together.
Okay.
When did you come to Hoag?
It was 2016.
Okay, yes. Okay.
And when did you start with Hoag?
2006.
Six. Okay.
Yeah. But I knew of Dr. Savalia through Dr. Silverstein, and I actually had already sent you a couple patients and a couple friends of mine.
Yeah. Wow.
Fortunately or unfortunately, who needed you.
Well, it's great to have you here at Hoag. I think your combined expertise in both OB-GYN as well as breasts, I think, give you a unique view on women and what they're going through this whole process. And I think it's what you have to say and what they learn from you is going to be pretty interesting for us to show our viewers. So,
Casey
and Lisa.
Yeah. So, as I mentioned, you lead the high-risk clinic at Hoag.
Yes.
Let's just start with what that even means.
Really good question. So actually, every woman over about the age of 30 should know what her breast cancer risk is. And there are risk calculators that you can actually find and run for yourself online. The most accurate includes a mammographic density. So the best is come in, get a mammogram, find out your density. And then those of us who've had mammograms know when you come in for a mammogram, you enter all your own history. When did your period start? How old were you? Have you ever taken contraception? How old were you when you had your first pregnancy? When you had your first baby? Did you ever breastfeed? As you get older, when did your period stop? Of course, family history is important. All of that goes into a mix, including your breast density, and spits out a score. And pretty much every breast center will run that when you get your mammogram. Not all of them report it back to the patient. Sometimes it just goes back to your doctor. So if you can't find it on your own mammogram report, then you should call your doctor. Your doctor has it. And we consider anything over 20% elevated risk. Now that bar is set pretty low, because the first thing I like to do when someone comes to me in a near panic that their risk is 21% is turn that number around. You have an almost 80% chance you're never going to get breast cancer. So definitely not time for panic, just a plan of how are we going to manage this. Mm-hmm. But I've seen people walking with risks as high as 60, 70, 80%. And then a risk that high, you might make different choices about what you want to do next. So that's the first thing, is know your breast cancer risk. You can actually find something called the IBIS score calculator online, and you can run it yourself. So if you know your mammographic density from your mammogram report, because it used to be just in California, now there's a national law that every mammogram report has to release your mammographic density to you. If you know that, you can actually go into that calculator. You can find it online. It's free, and run it yourself.
Wow.
Yeah. It is also gets run repeatedly, because you can imagine all those things I said about your personal history and your family history, it changes over time. So that's the other thing, is that you may have been one risk 5 years ago, but then it may go up and down, depending on if you have additional family history that was unknown before, mm-hmm. or as you have more children, or now you go into menopause, things will change and your density will change over time. So it's not a static number. It's not like, well, at 32, my risk was this, and that's my risk for my life. It actually changes and fluctuates over time.
Mm-hmm. So you brought up, having children. What about your young patients, unfortunately? I know I can imagine that those are tough conversations to have with them based off of their age. You know, what about those women who haven't been married, haven't become mothers, haven't started that part of their life yet? How do you guide them with their journey that they're about to start?
Well, so the first thing is it's really pregnancy before the age of 30 that's protective. So all of us who waited till our mid-30s, I was almost 40, like we missed the boat in terms of breast cancer risk. But the other thing is, don't make your life about your breast cancer risk. Like, live your life, and then we'll kind of figure out how risk management fits around it. So this is really where I'm an OBGYN at heart, right? Mm-hmm. Like, to me, family is everything. Figure out the family that you want and have it, and let us kind of figure out around when your partner came along in life or when that opportunity came along in life to have your family. Don't try and have children young just about breast cancer. Because I see women all the time who are like, I don't understand. I got breast cancer. I had my first baby at 24. And what we're talking about is there is something called the population risk factor, which means of 1,000 women, the women most likely to get breast cancer are the ones who have pregnancies after the age of 30. It all falls apart when you're talking about the woman sitting across from you. It's still certainly possible to get breast cancer even if you had 3 kids before you were 30. So there's not quite that tight correlation. So I tell young women, just lead your life, and as it unfolds, we will help you figure out how to manage this.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. And not when we see young patients in here, it's always relative to me, because I feel like they're always close to my age, and it's an eye-opener.
Gets worse the older you get. No, then they start getting younger than you. Now I'm starting to have patients that are close in age to my kids. Those heartbreaks never quite, or those heartstrings just keep getting pulled on.
Yeah.
The other thing I should bring up with risk is what I mentioned, family history, and that's usually the first thing we think of with risk. Actually, most breast cancer is not related to your family history. But if you have a strong family history of breast cancer, can be linked to ovarian cancer, then someone in your family should come in for genetic testing. Yeah. Because we can identify families that carry genes where your risk is as high as 70, 80, 90%. And that's powerful information to have of how we manage that, rather than we see all the time, someone comes in, unfortunately, with a new diagnosis of breast cancer, then they tell us their family history and we're like, wow, I wish someone had come in for testing earlier.
Right.
Because, you know, if every woman in your family's had breast cancer, specifically at young ages, somebody needs to figure out what's happening there.
Yeah.
So who's the best person for that patient to turn to if they have a concern?
So ideally, primary care, OBGYN are all trained to pick up on this. And more it's becoming better known in medical circles as just part of the routine intake for your annual. Every primary care should be asking, you know, anything change in your family history in the past year every time you see a doctor. But it's also something a patient could walk in and say, like, I think I need to tell you, my mother, my sister got breast cancer this year. And hopefully the first question the doctor would say is, what was her genetic testing? We used to do genetic testing only if families had many women who were young with breast cancer. And then the American Society of Breast Surgeons did a study of which we were part at Hoag, where, and it was pre-COVID, so it feels like it was 20 years ago, but it was probably 6 years ago, where the next 1,000 women that walked into 20 different centers in the country, we just tested them all for breast cancer genes if they had breast cancer, regardless of their age or family history. And we found that twice as many families carried the genes as we would have thought.
Wow.
Not all the genes have risks as high as 70 to 80%. Some of the risks are a lot lower. But that's still powerful information for a family to have.
Sure.
Sometimes, often, the waterworks start in a new cancer consult when we get to, and what does this mean for your kids, right? Mm-hmm. Most of us moms will, like, stop the moving train to protect our children, but the idea that something affected our kids is where we kind of lose it. Mm-hmm. But this is powerful information for your kids. If I walked into a doctor's office and said, my mother has just had breast cancer, I would hope that doctor would say, what was her genetic testing? And then we can start to figure out, what does that mean for you? But a patient can ask for it. My mother or my sister just had breast cancer. Is there some kind of genetic test we should be doing here? You know, a patient can certainly ask that question.
Sure.
Wow. So if you have a genetic test done and you find one of the known mutations, right, that are associated with high risk,
right,
that's an easy discussion, not an easy discussion, but a...
Easy.
Yeah, you can discuss based on data.
Yes.
How about these other mutations that sometimes are found that are sometimes unknown significance? What do you do with those?
So good question. We talk about genetic testing like a pregnancy test. You pee on a stick, it's a yes or a no. And it turns out even pregnancy tests aren't that uncomplicated, but certainly cancer genetics is not that uncomplicated. So there is something called a VUS, or a variant of undetermined significance, which literally means we don't know how to interpret the test. The way those tests are done, they literally sequence the molecules in the gene for each person, for each one of these genes. Now, we have overpopulated the earth with a whole bunch of people who don't all look the same, which means all of our genes, the molecules and sequence in our genes are very different. So once they have sequenced that gene, they look for patterns. Some patterns they recognize, oh, we know that gene doesn't work. Okay, then that's a gene that is usually linked to the development of cancer. But you can imagine many of these patterns are gonna be like, I don't know, we've never seen that before. And they call that undetermined significance. Over 98% of those, they eventually figure out, mean nothing. It just means why we have overpopulated the earth with people who don't all look the same. Every now and then they do just figure out, oh, that one's significant. So we treat, and this is important, we treat those undetermined significance as a negative result, because 98% of them will eventually be told, like, no, that's not harmful to you. And that's really important. That's one way these tests get misinterpreted. Equally confusing is when every person in your family, so let's pick on me, grandmother, mother, and sister have all had breast cancer. No one's testing positive for anything. Grandmother, this all happened before testing was available, but my mother and my sister have had full panel testing. So how do you tell, what do you say to my sister's daughter? What do you say to me? Breast cancer is everywhere, but we don't know why. That's when you come back to this calculated risk score, and that's actually how it sometimes gets as high as like 70%. You can't discount there's something in that family. We just don't know what it is or what to call it.
So do you treat a patient with that kind of family history, but no known genetic mutation, the same as somebody who does have a genetic mutation? Do you counsel them the same way and suggest that your risks are high and you should be considering either risk-reducing mastectomies, or if you actually have breast cancer, be considering double mastectomies?
Really good question. And I know you're asking this because sometimes, and the answer is I drag you into it with me. So you and I have treated patients like that before. Before I answer that, and this is literally how I walk patients through this, let's talk about the difference between a recommendation and an option. So a recommendation is, there is data to support that this is hands down the best thing we can do for you. And if you don't want to do it, we really have to dig into why, because this is really what you need and we are confident in that. That's a recommendation. An option is, a reasonable person could choose to do this, but if you hate the idea, there are other choices we can make, so you don't need to pursue, you don't have to, and I don't need to push. So in breast cancer, for actually even for the gene carriers, and we're talking about BRCA among others, or for people with a strong family history that's unexplained, or even people with that high risk score, but no positive genetic test, the recommendation is high risk screening with a mammogram every year and an MRI every year. That's the best level of screening we can do. And the reason that's the recommendation is, we can diagnose breast cancer early. And when diagnosed early, for most women, it is survivable. So the recommendation is the screening. That doesn't mean it's her only choice, but that's the one we really, if you if you don't want to do the screening, we really have to push into why. And there are reasons why people have misgivings. We all hear about it all the time. People have fears of radiation from mammography, which, by the way, is the same amount of radiation you get flying from California to New York. And we don't limit how many times people fly, so don't worry about getting one mammogram a year. But people also worry about the MRI. There's a contrast called gadolinium. People don't like the idea of getting that every year. Your healthy kidney will get rid of it. It's not worth worrying about. But I also understand people don't, they're just not comfortable with it. If you're claustrophobic, the MRI is miserable. Have to have an MRI every year. Have very strong opinions about how to make it easier. But I also relate to why the screening's not easy. 364 days out of a year, I don't think that MRI is a big deal. The day I climb into that machine, every year I'm like, oh man, I really hate this. Yeah. So I understand, and I'm happy always to drug people for that day just to make it easier, but I never remember to drug myself, which is kind of silly. Anyway, the screening's the recommendation is the point. The options, meaning these are reasonable options we can talk through, and you may decide this is the best choice for you, but I don't need to push it on you if you don't want to. The options are risk-reducing hormone blockers for 5 years. Over the age of 35, take the hormone blocker for 5 years, you cut your risk in half. So that's powerful protection. There are whole chat rooms and blogs dedicated to how much people hate those drugs. The younger you are, the more menopausal you will feel. Menopause is not usually so fun that people want to do that more than once. Right. And 5 years is a long time to not feel great. Yeah. You know, an antibiotic that makes you queasy for a week, like, suck it up. But 5 years, especially in some really busy, active years, both in people's family and professionally, that's a heavy lift. Mm-hmm. But for women who want to do that, it's a really successful medication. This is old data, huge studies with like 14,000 women in them. So we're very confident of that. But it's not a recommendation because the side effects are real. The other option is the risk-reducing mastectomy. It is the most protective thing we can do. It drops risk about 90 to 95%. It doesn't remove every cell. The breast cells come right to the back of the skin. I can remove them all, but then reconstructive surgeons like Dr. Savaglia will have a heart attack because all the skin will die. So literally, to protect the skin, I have to save scattered cells all over the back of the skin. So it's not 100% protection. That's the first thing people need to know. It's not the easy way out. It's a hard choice to make, but now I'm done. Not at all. But it is the most powerful way we can protect you. Many women actually make that choice because they're so sick of the screening.
Yeah.
So, for example, I just saw a patient who's had 6 biopsies over the past 5 years. She's done. Mm-hmm. She's like, every time I walk in here, you people biopsy something. And I hate to tell her, her breasts are very busy on imaging. I feel like our imaging fails her. I can't tell her that this won't keep happening because I can see 12 other things that I could decide to biopsy. Mm-hmm. So strong family history, high risk, all genetic testing negative. She came in asking for bilateral mastectomy. She wants off this merry-go-round mm-hmm. of screening and biopsy and screening and biopsy. When we talk about the harms of screening, that's it. I mean, it's scary to go through those biopsies. They hurt. It's hard to argue. She said, so we leave tiny little metal clips, so small you can barely feel it between your fingers, every time we do a biopsy, just so we know where we biopsied and we got tempted to do that again. She literally walked in saying, you know, if you shake me, I think I rattle. I have so many of these things in here. It's hard to argue, right? It's hard to argue. It's hard to look at that woman and say, no, you don't need this.
Right.
You know, she's having this lived experience. You have to honor that. Mm-hmm. So the way I approach patients is I have all this medical scientific knowledge and more than 15 years experience of doing this. You have an inner compass of what makes sense in your life, and we need to bring those two things together. And so while it's not recommended to have a bilateral mastectomy, even for our gene carriers, it's not recommended because we can diagnose and treat your cancer. If either you want out of the screening, or even if I reassure you I can treat your cancer, if you don't want a cancer experience at all, full stop, mastectomy is still the most powerful thing we can do for you.
You know, one of the conversations that we hear online is somebody did that. They had a risk-reducing bilateral mastectomy, and now are convinced that anybody who's dealing with any breast issue should just do that. Mm-hmm. How do you talk to that patient who comes to you and says, everybody I know has had double mastectomies, and I have this little lesion in my breast that may be consequential and inconsequential,
right?
But I want them off.
Right.
What do you say?
Or it's other twin sister of, well, my neighbor had a lumpectomy and she recurred. Mm-hmm. But my other neighbor had mastectomies and she's never recurred. Mm-hmm. So clearly everyone's going to recur after you have a lumpectomy. And this is kind of where we have to go back to what we know the studies have shown. The vast majority of women who've had lumpectomies do not recur. So of a few things that I try to see if I can help her get some perspective, the women who have not recurred are not walking around saying, look at me, I haven't recurred, right?
Right.
They're back in their life doing something else.
Right.
Not saying that the women who have recurred aren't allowed to have their devastating experience that they've recurred to talk about it to all their friends. But just because that happened to one person doesn't mean it happens to everyone. So what all the science and the studies show is that lumpectomy and mastectomy have equivalent survival rates, and that the recurrence rates are nearly equivalent, if not the same. So despite my whole speech just now about the most powerful thing we can do to protect you is mastectomies, actually what I think for breast cancer patients is, if a larger operation is not going to make you live longer, by definition, the smaller operation is better. Mm-hmm. You will have a faster recovery. You will have far less pain. Mastectomy is really trading one problem for another. It's not an answer. It's not an out. It's numbness. It's often a lot of physical therapy because of the scarring and the tightness. And that for many women is a recurring thing. It's not like PT for 2 months and then I moved on. Right. It's daily exercises to keep everything stretched out. And then every couple years going back in for like a tune-up because things tightened up again. However you were reconstructed, you're gonna have scars. Your body will feel and work differently. If there are implants, you'll always have the knowledge there's something else in there that has to be revised at some point, probably not 10 years from now, but certainly 15 by 20. If you have autologous reconstruction where we rebuild with, well, I don't, other really brilliant surgeons rebuild with your own tissue, that's a lot of work to go through. And you will always have scars and you will always have reminders that this happened to you. So mastectomy is really trading one problem for another. Now, some women are happy to make that choice, but this isn't, nothing in life is free. There's no easy way out of any of this. So if all of that doesn't appeal, a lumpectomy conserves your own breast. So your sense of intactness is much stronger at the end of this because it's still your own tissue. It's what you were born with. The sensation is still what you're used to for you and your partner. That's really important for both of you. Some women have a mastectomy and it's often numb. Over 70% of women have significant sensory loss, which means maybe this used to be their personal playground and she may not really like to be touched anymore. That could be a really challenging thing for a partnership to navigate, especially if they don't know how to talk to each other. So in our program for our gene carriers, we have a wonderful sexual health psychologist, and I have her meet everyone before and after. And it's a pretty funny moment. Partner comes in with a patient who's a gene carrier. She's chosen to have mastectomy. And it's usually a he in this scenario because the female partners are usually way more in tune with this.
Right.
Not to pick on men.
No offense.
He's sitting there being a wonderfully supportive partner. Yeah. And then I bring up, okay, let's talk about how this might change your sexuality and your intimacy. And you can see he's kind of relieved because maybe he's been worrying about it. Mm-hmm. But when everyone else is talking about cancer, he doesn't want to be like that guy who's talking about sex.
Right.
So he's like, okay, good. Somebody is talking about this. And then I mentioned, okay, we have this wonderful psychologist. I want you both to go in and talk to her. And, she'll give you language so you can talk about with each other. And then he is now like, what? You want me to go talk to a what? About what? Like, and I'm like, oh boy, you need help. You need help to talk about this. Or if he's like, yep, great, I'm there, let's go. I'm like, yeah, you guys are fine.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if you're that comfortable with it, you two are fine.
Yeah.
But that's how life-changing a mastectomy can be. Whereas going back to what you asked me, the lumpectomy has far fewer of those effects. Mm-hmm. So despite the fact that I'm sitting here making an argument for why if a woman decides mastectomy is her right next choice, she should have that option. For a cancer patient, I still stand by that philosophy. You know, if a smaller operation will be just as good cancer treatment as a bigger operation, the smaller operation is always better. Easier on your body, lower complication rates, faster recovery just to feeling like you. And the studies show that 5 years, 10 years after a cancer diagnosis, the women who conserve their breast have much less grief and much stronger sense that they came through this intact than the women who have mastectomies, even if they don't regret their decision to have mastectomy. They still have this experience of loss.
Let me ask you, I've had patients before, and I didn't realize this was a thing, who said, you know, I broke a one or two, I can't remember, but... And she said, my doctor's telling me I need to have my prophylactic mastectomies as soon as possible. Why are some patients are encouraged to do it as soon as possible and others are like, well, we can just watch it and we can just see and we'll go from there. What factors play into that decision? When are they told they need to have their prophylactic mastectomies?
So when all the data came out that demonstrated what the risks are with these genes, these genes are rare and it took a long time to find enough people who had them that we had any kind of robust data and not just, well, five people and what happened to them, which is never a good way to make a medical decision. So when the early data came out, it was just terrifying statements like their risk of breast cancer is 70%. And for BRCA1 in particular, it's a high risk of a particularly virulent kind of breast cancer. We're talking about breast cancer like it's all one disease. It's not. It's like six or seven different diseases, some of which, if you catch them early, is probably no chemo. You could do a quick little lumpectomy. You could be back to normal, maybe a little radiation. Others are, even if we catch it early, this is going to be months of chemotherapy and a particularly strong chemotherapy where you may have neuropathy afterwards. It's kind of more that full-blown cancer experience that people might be trying to avoid. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what we knew at first. And so there was a lot of enthusiasm like, oh, wow, we can actually prevent this whole experience. Better data, better studies have now given us a better way to track breast cancer risk over time. And I don't necessarily expect your average doctor, certainly primary care, who knows way more about cholesterol and bone health than I ever will know in my life, to realize that, no, there's actually a way to chart her risk over time. And I can usually show these, especially really young women, mm-hmm. like the chance that something bad happens to you in the next 5 years is like 4%, 95% chance or greater. None of this is going to happen yet. So let's all calm down now.
Yeah.
You know, they come in with a lot of pressure in their life to get this done. And sometimes it's my job to be like, okay, let's slow this train down. Mm-hmm. No one makes a good decision when you're feeling pressured, right? Mm-hmm. The good news is let's take all the pressure off. And sometimes I have to like, let's get your mom on the phone because it's someone in their life who loves them, but who's really scared. Mm-hmm. And so the good news is it's rare that somebody walks in and I'm like, okay, we have to make a decision for breast, for ovarian, whole different story. There actually is a date by which we're going to get really anxious if you still have your ovaries. We can't screen for ovarian cancer. And the risk really starts shooting up different ages by different genes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a complete contrast. Like, as the breast doctor, I'll walk in and be like, why do you still have your ovaries? And they'll be like, I want to talk about mastectomy. And I'm like, I want to talk about your ovaries. How about I do your mastectomy and while I'm doing it, someone sneaks in and takes your ovaries out? Because why do you still have ovaries? We kind of joke, my GYN oncology partner, Dr. Lisa Abate, who runs this with me, we kind of joke, we don't hate ovaries.
Right.
It's just we hate ovarian cancer. Yeah. We don't have a screening test. So sadly, for some women struggling with fertility, we run into that wall.
Yeah.
And we can talk about what we can do about that. But for breast, we're never in that situation. In fact, even if a carrier is diagnosed with breast cancer, there is some evidence she has a survival benefit from two mastectomies rather than lumpectomy. But if she's not ready to accept that, if the breast cancer itself was devastating enough, and we've done this before, okay, let's just do a lumpectomy and get rid of the cancer. at any time you could come back to us and say, okay, now I'm making the choice. I want to do mastectomy. Mm-hmm. But we can do this one step at a time. We don't have to make this so overwhelming. But I think sometimes doctors who, and understandably so, haven't spent as much time obsessing about this as some of us who do this every day, I don't think they get the nuances sometimes. And this is why a specialty clinic is so valuable. Mm-hmm. Like, come talk to those of us who, more confessions from what I told you earlier, Dr. Lisa Abade and Dr. Monica Levine are my GYN oncology partners. We go out to dinner and this is what we talk about. We literally talk about cancer screening and interventions and when they should happen. And it's a little embarrassing. Good wine, always. But come talk to somebody who literally thinks about this all the time. Right. And let us personalize it to you. There's, in fact, there's a new risk assessment tool out for carriers that is doing an even better job of this than the last one we had. So there are really ways to personalize this to her. So it's not this horrifying blanket statement of like, you have a 70% chance that the worst thing you can imagine is going to happen to you. Mm-hmm. Like, no. Let's really talk about you. And then let's make it fit in your life. It doesn't have to crash land on top of everything else.
So I have a follow-up question to this whole risk mm-hmm. reduction conversation, which is somebody's got a high-risk classification based on either genetics or other factors, and now they present to you having never had any surgery but now has a new breast cancer. Now, should they be considering double mastectomies or should they consider lumpectomy? Is that even an option? How do you talk to these women?
The good news is she still has options. There is only one gene that we know of and one that we suspect that carries not just a high risk of a first cancer, but a high risk of second cancers, either same breast or other side. And that's BRCA. And then something called PALB2 we suspect, but we don't have enough data yet. All the other cancer genes and then all the other high risk situations, generally, she was at risk for a first cancer, but that doesn't translate into you will still be at risk for more cancers in the future after you go through a cancer treatment. Sometimes that one is intuitively really hard to accept. Just because this happened once doesn't mean it will happen again. So that patient is pretty much in the same situation as any other newly diagnosed patient. We can make recommendations for lumpectomy or mastectomy based on the individual characteristics of her, which are generally how large is the area that's affected and how large is the breast and what cosmetic result do you want and are you willing to have radiation? Because after lumpectomy, most women benefit from radiation to protect the remaining breast. And it's back to our usual cancer conversation. Mm-hmm. Now, her experience of it might be, and this is something I hear commonly, breast cancer happens to every woman in my family, and so I'm done. I want them both removed. Again, it's still her option, but I don't have to recommend it. And if she hates the idea, if she comes in and says, please don't tell me I have to lose my breasts, then the good news is I can say, no, you don't. Assuming, again, the logistics work of how much do I need to remove and what is left and what can I leave for someone like you to remodel and put back together.
Great.
How do you guide your patients with mastectomy when they bring up this question to you? Because I know some patients will come in and ask you, Dr. McDonald's telling me, I have options, but I'm going to make my decision after meeting with you.
Mm-hmm. So that's related to the conversation about how is breast reconstruction performed if you're having a double mastectomy. And really what they're looking for is all the things you already discussed, which is how is this going to impact me and my life? How long is this whole thing going to take? What are my long-term consequences of a mastectomy? So some of them are related just to reconstruction. Some are just related just having a mastectomy alone. Even if you went flat, you might have some of these issues, which is needing physical therapy, having scar tissue, and having chronic discomfort in the breast. There is a post-mastectomy syndrome that exists. So all those things need to be discussed, as well as ramifications on sexuality, which is something that might be important to somebody, but might not be important to somebody else. So these are all things that we end up discussing during one of these consultations.
Yeah. I want to go back to when you brought up fertility. For women at risk who are younger, fertility becomes a huge concern. Why is it a huge concern to them?
So after a mastectomy, you won't be able to breastfeed. So it's very uncommon if a woman is saying, my family's not complete, or I would like to have another baby and the opportunity to breastfeed that baby, or I'm still breastfeeding the babies I have. It's very rare in a high-risk patient that I would say, like, I'm sorry, I have to interrupt those plans. This is kind of where I'm an OBGYN at heart. Have your family and let me fit this in around the rest of it. So frequently for high-risk patients, if they're coming in feeling pressured to undergo mastectomy, I'm the one who's actually like, we don't have to do that. Not now. You know, how many, usually my follow-up question is, some version of a crass way of putting it is, are you done with them? Would you like to have more children? Would you like to the opportunity to breastfeed those children? Then I don't want to do this surgery on you. Let me screen you. I can screen you forever. And then you can come back and tell me when you're ready. And most often that is when she's already made the decision, she wants a mastectomy, it's just a matter of the timing. Most often that's kind of where we land, is like, you tell me. And then we actually have the luxury of time, because this is not being driven by an external factor, where I can send her to get in the best physical shape that she can be, so when she comes to surgery, she recovers better. Mm-hmm. Your body will try and recover back to wherever it was before you started surgery. So it's actually really challenging to, after surgery, decide, now I want to be a certain level of physical health that I'm not at. It's much better get there before. A plastic surgeon might say, optimize your weight before we come in and do plastic surgery or reconstruction. There's a couple different ways that works. So when we have the luxury of time of, well, I would like to have another baby, I intend to breastfeed that baby for 18 months. So, you know, maybe 3 years from now is when we want to do this. It's like, great, let's make a plan to have your baby, breastfeed, help you recover, and then like physically get you to the point where this is really going to go well. You know, that's luxury for us when cancer patients are in a different situation.
Sure.
So I can't think of a single time that I've looked at someone and said, I'm sorry, you can't do that. I have to do mastectomies. Yeah. The other possibility is, because the other thing that sometimes drives patient anxiety, and this is a real anxiety, I don't mean to suggest it's not. My cousin got breast cancer at 28. Like, I'm 26 and I'm done. Like, I'm not taking that chance. I've been driving her to chemo every day, and I don't want to do that. You can still get pregnant after you have a mastectomy. It's not like removing your breast takes away your ability to have children. You will not breastfeed. But for some women, that's not a choice that they, when they're juggling all these priorities, that may be something they're willing to let go of. So again, it's that I have the experience and the scientific knowledge, but you know how you want your life to go. And like, we have to find how the two kind of fit together.
Yep.
Just briefly, because I brought it up before, the ovarian question is very different, of course. Mm-hmm. If we remove ovaries, those are actually what get, that is the female contribution to a pregnancy. So if we remove ovaries, we take your eggs away, you cannot spontaneously become pregnant. Now, there are many ways to preserve your ability to get pregnant. Mm-hmm. Freezing eggs used to be experimental. It has not been for decades now. It is a worked out technique that's very successful. So for women who are facing ovarian removal but haven't yet completed their family, they can freeze their eggs, have the ovarian removal that will protect them, conserve their uterus, and they're not going to get pregnant the fun old-fashioned way, but they can still get pregnant and carry their own child and deliver. So my message to young women who are terrified of this is, it's rare that we have to do something devastating without preserving and protecting your ability to have the family that you want. Mm-hmm. So don't be afraid to come in and ask. And again, this is where, you know, as an OBGYN at heart, I would be devastated if I had to take someone's future family away from them.
Yeah.
Right? That's like what our whole specialty is about.
Right.
So usually, you know, we're creative people. We can come up with plan A, B, C, and D. It may not be the way you picture it. It may not be easy.
But you have options.
But you have options.
Yeah.
And then I always also do bring up, there are many ways to become a family. And as a mom of teenage girls, mom is the one who shows up in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. Reliably, routinely, you're throwing up, you're having nightmares, that guy didn't call you back, whatever it is, right? Mom is the one who shows up. There are many, many ways to become a mom. Mm-hmm. For all the women who were unable to get pregnant and carry the way they thought.
So if a woman wants to preserve the option to bear children but has to have their ovaries removed, are all those fertility treatments covered by insurance?
Really good question, and depends on the circumstance. For our cancer patients, yes, that is actually a law. theoretically, there is the same protection for our carriers, like BRCA carriers. Mm-hmm. But that seems to be a lot fuzzier and grayer in practice. Mm-hmm. There are wonderful philanthropic foundations that will also cover this. So there was one called Fertile Hope that is now 10 years ago, become part of Livestrong. And they actually exist to provide financial help for families affected by cancer in some way who need fertility preservation. So there's a lot more help available than people may assume, because of course, everything we're talking about, the cost is astronomical and mm-hmm. out of reach for many people. Yeah. But again, I would encourage someone to ask the question and see if we can help connect you, rather than not seek the protection that you deserve because you're worried that no one's going to help you solve what is nearest and dearest to your heart, which is how do I still have my family?
Mm-hmm. As a certified menopause practitioner.
It's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful. How do you, or can you walk us through how estrogen and progesterone take a play in this?
100%. So estrogen and progesterone are our naturally occurring female hormones. Mm-hmm. Men have them too, women have more, that guide our reproductive tract, that in the reproductive years, as women have a reproductive cycle, are rising and falling in hopefully a very regular fashion that allows a woman every single month between the age of usually 12 to 13 to 50 to become pregnant. Menopause itself is when those hormones, when your ovaries start to quiet down, there's a natural end to that part of your life, and your ovaries quiet down and those levels fall. They don't fall to zero, they just fall to very low. When that system ramps up in 12 to 13, and when it quiets down in your 40s, hormones go out of whack. They go out of that regular cyclicity, and that often is what really causes symptoms. So our 12 to 13 year old girls with some of the mood changes that they have, the acne, how confusing life and overwhelming life can feel like, that is because their hormonal system is starting and it's not regular yet. But the same thing kind of happens in your 40s. It's like going back through adolescence again, only now you're an adult and you have to adult through your life, but acne. But as hormones swing, things that commonly come up, more breast pain, more breast cysts, that can be alarming. When women are now worried that they're getting into those years, they could develop breast cancer. I see a lot of people coming in for breast pain. It's a myth that cancer doesn't cause pain, but pain is very rarely caused by cancer. The other classic symptoms are hot flushes and moodiness and difficulty sleeping. And brain fog and weight redistribution. So it can be weight gain, but even if it's not overall weight gain, weight is redistributing itself not in the way you want it to. Suddenly, like, I may weigh the same, but now my jeans don't fit and I have no waistline anymore. Weight redistributes itself into a more male pattern, which is never what any woman was trying to do. That sort of all over the map hormone can be evened out by adding back regular amounts of estrogen to kind of even the whole system out, to kind of help bring this to a gentle landing rather than a crash landing, which is often what it feels like. The controversy about all of this is, what is the contribution to breast cancer of giving those hormones back? And there was a big study in 2001 that was interpreted to show that hormone replacement therapy causes breast cancer. And it was a New York Times headline, and every OBGYN who was alive at the time remembers where we were when the whole country flushed their Prempro down the toilet. And as a country, we all went into menopause in a week, and it didn't really go well. There was a whole lot of upset, freaking out. Women plus partners plus their families. That study was in many ways misinterpreted. That study was really about one oral medication, and the average age of the woman in that study was 65. And what was the contribution to breast cancer, which turned out to be 8 in 10,000 women beyond what their age predicted. Put it another way, and I often say this to my patients in Southern California, it is more dangerous to drive down the 405 freeway to ask me if hormones are dangerous than it is to take the hormone. Because yes, the risk of breast cancer is real, but it's so low and tiny, it almost ends up just part of the background noise of life. Mm-hmm. So thankfully, in 25 years now, almost, the sort of pendulums have swung and people are taking a much more reasonable look at hormones and that data. And I will say that one medication that that study looked at, we almost never prescribe anymore, because now we actually have ways to give women back the biologically same hormone that their bodies were making, which was not that pill that was studied way back in the day. So there really is very few reasons to not take hormone replacement if you are symptomatic. There is no reason that women need to suffer through this. There are very few women who can't take this. If you have a clotting disorder, these medications cause clots to a low degree, but it will trigger it in someone with a clotting disorder. There are certain kinds of migraines, not all of them, but certain kinds of migraines, hormones will increase your risk of stroke. If you've ever had a hormone-sensitive cancer, that is sort of the short list. For anyone else, if you're having symptoms where hormones could improve them, there's really no reason not to try it. The other controversy is, how long do you take it for? So again, old bad advice was lowest possible dose for shortest possible time. And I'm sorry, I'm going to pick a little on old male doctors now, which is not Dr. Savani. When men were doing menopausal research in the 60s and the 70s, they decided that menopause lasted 18 months, and any woman who complained of symptoms after 18 months got the psychiatric diagnosis of hysteria. Is where that word comes from. Wow. So times change. Women have access to education. Women get themselves into positions of designing and doing research. Attitudes change. I'm not saying that there aren't men who are contributing to this, but attitudes change. We get better research. Menopause is a 4 to 10 year process for most women. And 10 to 15% of women will have symptoms lifelong. And guess what? They're only hysterical when they're being mansplained that they're hysterical and that they're not having symptoms.
God forbid I have my feelings and my hormones controlling me.
Exactly. You know, it's kind of surprising right? Like, most of us get triggered by men explaining our own physiology to ourselves, mm-hmm. in contrast to what we are experiencing, right?
Right.
So for women having symptoms, there's really no reason not to try hormones. And then it is reasonable after a period of time. They used to say 3 to 4 years because they thought the risk started really going up at 4 years. But again, the risk is so low, it's almost like who cares. I usually say sort of 4 to 10 years later, let's, you know, maybe taper them off and start to see how you feel. And if it turns out your body has come through this transition, as a doctor, I feel like you should always know why you're on a medication. And if you don't need it anymore, stop.
Right.
That's just common sense. Mm-hmm. But if you turn out to be part of that 10 to 15%, and maybe I feel so strongly about this because every woman in my family has been menopausal till the day she died. So like, my poor 83-year-old mother is still having hot flushes. I know, can you imagine? If you're still having symptoms, it's not like you have an expiration date. Like, we're sorry, you got 5 years of relief and it's over and now you have to go back to suffering.
Right.
Like, no. If you're still having symptoms, treat the symptoms. You should just always know why you're on the medication and what you're treating. Now, for women who can't take hormones, or there's always a risk-benefit conversation, women who decide not to take hormones, thankfully, there's also other alternatives. The thing is, estrogen, sometimes combined with progesterone, sometimes combined with testosterone, covers the broadest amount of symptoms. By the time we're not using hormones, now we're piecemealing it. Okay, so for your mood disorder, we're going to try an anti-anxiety or an antidepressant. And this one might help with the hot flushes, so let's try that one. But if it doesn't, we can add something for the hot flushes, and you sort of end up piling, and that's how a woman ends up with, like, I take a handful of pills every day. Yeah. So to me, again, like everything in medicine, this is a personalized conversation. There's no blanket statement. Just go find a good doctor who will listen to you and listen to your symptoms. There is now actually something called a menopause consult, where it's a visit that's usually 30 to 60 minutes, and it's just focused on this. and figuring out what your options are. Like, there's a theme today, right? What are your options and what fits in your life? That's the partnership. I bring the experience and the knowledge of what your options are. You bring how your life works, and then we figure out where the two fit.
It could probably be an entire different episode just on that.
Oh, yeah. Actually, yeah. Menopause this in breast cancer survivors. Oh, yeah. We could do a whole
episode.
Well, let's segue into that even for a few minutes, which is hormone replacement is great for somebody who doesn't have breast cancer, but somebody who has a hormone sensitive breast cancer being treated and you're treating them with hormone blockers. How do you talk to them? What do those patients go through? Is hormone replacement therapy even an option for them?
Yep. So really good questions. I'm going to tackle the last one first. Not all breast cancers are the same. If your breast cancer is not hormone sensitive, and by that we mean estrogen receptor negative, progesterone receptor negative, and we shorthand it as ERPR negative. Actually, more and more, we are realizing those women can be a candidate for hormones if they need them. And that's really important because the classic person who has that is 42 years old. She had something called triple negative breast cancer, which is hormone negative breast cancer. She was a BRCA carrier, so we took her ovaries out. So she didn't survive breast cancer just to get ovarian cancer. But now she's menopausal at 42 and she's suffering. That woman is a great candidate for hormone replacement. And in fact, there is really good data if a woman loses her ovarian function before the age of 45 for any reason. It could be autoimmune disorders, it could be surgery, it could be cancer. If you do not add her estrogen back, you actually shorten her life. There is a survival cost to it, an overall survival cost due to cardiac problems and bone health. So the recommendation, I call it estrogen add back. This isn't hormone replacement. It's like if your thyroid fails, we give you thyroid hormone. If your ovaries fail before 45 years old, we need to give you ovary hormone unless we can't, which is the question you're asking. So young women who, premenopausal women who have an estrogen sensitive breast cancer, if we block the estrogen in their body, and there's a couple ways to do it, they have a survival advantage. Because that estrogen, unfortunately, is actually feeding the potential of a second tumor. So you can either give them a medication that allows their ovaries to continue to make ovarian hormone, estrogen and progesterone, but blocks it at their breast. Common one that people have heard of is tamoxifen. Mm-hmm. People hate that drug. That's the one where there's like whole chat rooms dedicated to how miserable that drug is. Actually, the data shows about 50% of women have side effects and about 50% of women don't. Mm-hmm. So for women who are nervous about it, I'm like, try it. We'll know in 6 weeks if you're miserable. Okay, we know which side of the line on. But if you're not, you know, don't go in the chat room and be like, I don't know, I feel fine. Yeah. So I'll come after you.
Exactly.
But the good news is it's a good option for you. What they go through is menopausal symptoms. And the ones they talk about the most are the sleep disturbances and the hot flushes. Mm-hmm. And by hot flushes, it's like sitting in this room. If I had a hot flush, you would see it. I would turn bright purple and you would watch me sweat through my clothes. And that is uncomfortable, disruptive, and embarrassing in your social and your professional life. Mm-hmm. So I've had patients come in and they're like, I work in a tech industry. I'm usually in a room with like 25-year-old men. This happens to me. And they're like, oh, my mom does that. You know, and she's like, oh, just kill me now. Like, this is miserable. So We have options where we can help her manage that. There's a medication, and I don't work for this drug company. I should, but I don't. I'm like their best salesperson. There's a medication that came out 2 years ago called phenylizotant. It's being marketed as something called Veozah. And it actually works in the same way that estrogen does at the temperature center in your brain. And there's in some studies, it worked as well as estrogen. We've been using it now for a couple years. It has been a game changer for our young women. I remember the first woman I tried it on, a month later, she texted me. She hadn't slept in 18 months. She had not slept through the night. She texted me a month later, I sleep like a baby. Yeah, it like made me tear up.
Can I get it?
Yeah.
Exactly. We should all be on this. In real practice, now that I've prescribed it to more people, it helps. It's a game changer. It's not a solution. You will still have hot flushes. But they shouldn't be that disruptive. They should be more manageable now. Mm-hmm. You have to follow liver function tests. There was a huge case in the news recently. Somebody died of liver failure. Well, their doctor should have been checking. You're supposed to check liver function tests every 3 months for the first year. And there's strict guidelines about when you stop it. So clearly somebody there dropped a ball. I'm sorry for the person who lost their life. But people shouldn't be afraid to try it because of that. You know, those of us who know how to manage it. And a cancer patient's usually on blood tests that frequently anyway. It really wouldn't be any different. So that's a good option. But there's an anti-anxiety medication called Paxil that is FDA approved to treat hot flushes. So if someone's struggling with anxiety and hot flushes, often that's one that I try. Like maybe we can kind of improve two things at once. There's a nerve pain medication, gabapentin, that works really well. Lexapro and Effexor can also work really well for hot flushes. So unfortunately, you end up in this situation where you're on the tamoxifen and then we're adding things to manage the side effects of the tamoxifen. And again, things, you know, a perfectly healthy woman walks in like, I'm on a whole handful of pills every day now. Mm-hmm. Like, what happened to me?
Yeah.
But circling back to that cancer survivor's experience, you have to address those side effects because a study came out, again, pre-COVID, so it feels like 20 years ago, that showed that among cancer survivors, the world's most motivated people to not do that again, only 50% are still taking their hormone blockers at 2.5 years. And the recommendation is at least 5. Mm-hmm. And it kind of breaks my heart that they've had to make that choice between protecting themselves and being able to just live their daily life. Like, we need to do a much better job of this.
Yeah.
The other way, and this one's even a little harder, for high-risk breast cancer. So a young premenopausal woman with a hormone-sensitive breast cancer that was either very aggressive or more advanced, they actually get put in a situation where we biochemically shut down their ovarian production completely, and then we put something on top of that. And they often are even more symptomatic than that. And it's a challenge. And everyone acknowledges this is the big challenge.
Sure.
Hopefully we're developing better ways to look at this. There's some interesting thought that there might be, we talk about estrogen like it's one thing. It's actually probably 4 or 5 different chemicals in your bloodstream. And maybe one of them binds a different estrogen receptor and may actually be an option for this. Personally, I haven't seen enough safety data around it that I'm comfortable doing that, but some medical oncologists more and more are thinking that maybe that's an actual option, even for our estrogen-sensitive patients. Okay. So, you know, hopefully, as medicine goes on, we get better at this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Dr. McDonald, before we wrap up today, what is one thing you would like to leave our viewers and listeners with?
Oh, only one?
Only one.
If there's one thing that I would like people to hear from this, it's find that partnership with your doctor. I think the theme to everything I've said today is most often you have options. There's more than one way to manage something. We aren't going to be able to pick the best option for you. We're going to be able to tell you the pros and the cons. But for each woman, she's going to have to do the math in her head of her body and her life and how she wants to live her life. And so which option fits for her? And that is the partnership between a doctor and a patient. Mm-hmm. And if you don't feel like you've found that with your doctor, if you don't feel like your doctor's listening to you, if you don't feel like your doctor is answering your questions, if they just kind of walk in and say, this is what we're doing now, personally, I would say keep looking.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are doctors out there who will sit there and partner with you and find the best fit. Because for a doctor, if I find the option that really fits in your life, you'll do it. Mm-hmm. The best, the treatment that works is the one that you will do. Mm-hmm. So I can hand something that I think is a great idea. If it doesn't fit in your life and you won't do it, I haven't solved your problem at all. I haven't helped you at all.
And that goes for anything.
Any part of medicine.
Yep.
But especially around this where emotions can run really high.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us today.
Yes, and
I learned a lot, honestly. High risk was something that I was pretty naive to before our conversation today. So thank you.
Thank you.
If you found today's podcast helpful, please share it with others who you think will find it helpful too. You are not alone in this, and find the right doctor. Please subscribe and continue to listen into future podcasts. Thank you.